Do you agree with me that Americans know far too little about the world? Foreign policy questions are complicated, with historical influences far too complex for our soundbite-dependent, short attention span culture. These days, once we get past celebrity gossip, the horse race of the presidential campaign, the daily bad news on the economy, melting ice caps, Iraq, we have little energy left for the rest of the globe. Samantha Power has focused for years on the rest of the world, especially on its darkest corners. She teaches at Harvard. She's won a Pulitzer Prize. She's a key foreign policy advisor to Barack Obama. And she joins me today to shed a little light on the role of the U.S. in the world. Samantha Power is professor of practice of global leadership and public policy based at Harvard's Carr Center for Human Rights, where she was the founding executive director. Her book, A Problem from Hell, America in the Age of Genocide, was awarded the 2003 Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Her New Yorker article on the horrors in Darfur, Sudan, won the 2005 National Magazine Award for Best Reporting. She spent 2005 and 2006 working in the office of Senator Barack Obama and remains a foreign policy advisor to the candidate. Her latest book is Chasing the Flame, Sergio Vieira de Mello and the Fight to Save the World, a biography of the UN envoy killed by a suicide bomber in Iraq. Welcome, Samantha Power.
Great to be here.
Okay. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we deal with. So you were born in Ireland. You moved to the States at age 9, something which, as I was preparing, I thought somewhat similar to Barack Obama's sort of situation, you know. But how do you think that might have impacted your view of the U.S. and the world?
Well, probably just as a kid, I would have always had an eye to Ireland, to international affairs. My whole family stayed there. I came over with my mother and my kid brother. Everybody else remained. So I think perhaps I just had one eye outside of the United States in a way that, as a sports fan and you know, soap opera watcher, I may not have had that extra peripheral vision, if not for having been born elsewhere. But also, I suppose, a little bit of an eye to conflict and sectarian conflict and so forth, in the sense of how truly reasonable people can take up arms and against their neighbors quite suddenly, or where conflicts that just seem like they should be passé in the 21st century can persist just out of sentiment and emotion. So I've had a sense of that. I mean, when you grow up in a family where you denounce violence, but some members of your family cheer the IRA, you at least have some vague sense of how the kind of cognitive and moral dissonance that one can keep within oneself.
Yeah, yeah. You went to Harvard Law School, which I didn't know until I was preparing for this. Did you know then that you wanted to become a journalist?
No, I was already a journalist. I actually was giving up on journalism. I had been a journalist in Bosnia during the war there for 2.5 years, and then felt like we in the press corps, and there was an amazingly vibrant press corps, people of all ages just flocking to Bosnia, actually almost like the Spanish Civil War. I mean, really believing that something truly vital was at stake just in the immediate wake of the Cold War. And we had all gone there with these big dreams that information was power, and then it just seemed as though the killing was going to be allowed to continue day to day to day to day to day, and it was heartbreaking to watch. So I said, enough with this. You've got to, you know, it's one thing to write about it, but I've got to put myself in a position where I can be the recipient of coverage like this, be the recipient of heartbreaking news like this, and maybe be able to do something about it. So I went to law school thinking maybe I could become a prosecutor at The Hague and get the bad guys. And then while I was in law school, I needed to somehow make sense of the experience that I'd had in the former Yugoslavia and the experience of watching NATO planes fly overhead and do nothing about concentration camps. So that's when I began work on what was actually a school paper, a paper for a class, that then would morph into the book that became A Problem from Hell, which was to try to situate the U.S. response to the former Yugoslavia in a larger historical context of how we responded to mass atrocity and genocide more generally. So then I mission creep, and I know
right.
I'm still a journalist. I don't know what the hell I am, but
right. No, it's interesting. Yeah,
several things.
Your bio say journalist, but she's at Harvard, but she's advising a candidate.
Yeah, it's very weird. Yeah. It used to be dualism. Now I don't know what the expression is, but it all feels like the same enterprise, which is how do you fix American foreign policy and how do you use whatever you have at your, I know that sounds completely grandiose, and I don't mean that there's an easy fix or that I can,
or that you can
make,
do it,
make an impact, exactly. But it all sort of feels, there's a terrible expression, which is the head of the New York Times used once about, he was getting into multimedia, and he said, I'm platform agnostic. dreadful expression, but I somehow feel that way about myself. I'm agnostic about what it is I'm doing day to day, but the enterprise feels as if it's just sort of strands weaving into one.
Yeah, I mean, again, not to put myself even on that level, but I do speeches and trainings to nonprofits on how to better communicate, and then I come on the radio and try to find people
right,
who are
very similar.
And I, you know, I say it's all the same thing. It's just how many hours do you have, and how many things can you do?
Yeah, absolutely.
You were mentioning that experience in the Balkans. I think one of the things that's in the news when we get to it today is what's going on in Kosovo, and I confess ignorance. What's the brief tale of what is happening there, and are there good guys and bad guys, and what should happen?
The good guys are the civilians, really, in both places who never come out on top in these conflicts. They're always sort of thugs and nationalists who take advantage of the turmoil. Basically, NATO intervened in Kosovo back in 1999, and because the U.S. and the Russians certainly came to verbal blows over that intervention, and the U.S. bypassed the U.N. Security Council in order to intervene. In the immediate aftermath of the war, in the interest of kissing and making up, the U.S. and the Russians came together and they said, okay, let's just kick the can down the road. Let's just agree to disagree. We'll put the U.N. in charge of Kosovo. We hope that, you know, somewhere 5 minutes from now, 5 years from now, this will become clear and the tectonic plates will shift. We'll just stall, basically. And the
we'll,
U.N.
We'll put a cap on it, sort of.
Yeah.
It's festering, but it's not hot right now.
Yeah. So Serbia will no longer be governing Kosovo, but Kosovars will no longer be governing, will not be governing
That's
Kosovo.
That's the part that was surprising to me.
Either, exactly. So, I mean, this was interesting, the guy we'll talk about in a minute, Sergio Vieira de Mello, was in fact the kind of UN viceroy presiding, governing Kosovo back in 1999. He would have seen all of this coming. I mean, basically, what international statesmen have come to think is that somehow if you're carrying a UN flag or if you put the UN in charge of something, that peoples who want to govern themselves will say, oh, okay, well, because it's the UN, that's fine. Then I don't mind picking up, you know, my own garbage or coming up with my own currency or my own flag or deciding what free speech is. You know, I'll just let a Brazilian do it or a Frenchman do it. And it turns out that that's just not how the human condition works. They certainly would prefer, I suppose, a UN occupation to a Russian occupation or an American occupation, in the sense that they would presume less of a role for self-interest, economic interest, national security interest, which single
of
states
a particular
might,
nation, yeah,
yeah, of a particular nation. But in the ethnic Albanians, nearly 2 million of them bristled under this UN occupation, wanted to govern themselves, and basically it came to the point where you couldn't put Kosovo back into Serbia again after everything the Kosovars had gone through, and because it's 90% ethnic Albanian, so you can put it could not put Humpty Dumpty back together again. But what you somehow needed to do was get rid of the UN occupation and allow ethnic Albanians a chance to govern themselves, while also looking out for the 10% of Kosovo that is Serbian, and also having an eye to Serbia proper, which sees Kosovo as its cultural and religious heartland. And basically, we bungled it. I mean, we didn't do the kind of diplomacy behind the scenes or create a very coherent economic pathway for Serbia.
In those years, once the stall plan had gone into effect, you keep working. And if you work really well and you're lucky, then what's happening now doesn't happen?
Yeah, well, or at least less of what's happening now. That there would have been a respect for the Serbian minority, you know, not a sense of spasming into paying attention. I mean, we could have handled the Russia problem better, I think, by making them feel more enlisted earlier. At some point, something had to give.
Yeah.
This was never going to be pretty. Either Serbs were going to be upset or ethnic Albanians were going to be upset, or we were going to continue to stall.
So the last few weeks,
The United States, the Kosovars declared independence because it became clear that Russia, I mean, ideally this would have gone through the UN Security Council, but the same Russia that didn't want NATO to intervene in the first place, the same Russia that has backed Serbia over the years relatively consistently, didn't want the UN system as a whole to recognize Kosovar independence. That would have been, I mean, Putin is planting flags on the North Pole. You know, this is just one more way also of him showing the West that he's not, doesn't preside over a defeated superpowers. I guess we treated him in the 1990s, and there's a lot of kind of payback that he's
that he's able.
In the midst of. He is able.
He's not only doing, but he's able to do.
He is able to. I mean, it's a much more multipolar world, and I think the Bush administration, but also the Democratic establishment, are going to have a hard time adjusting to the fact that when you go to the UN Security Council, you can't simply snap your fingers and expect all the powers on the council to go along with you, that you've got to sort of give a little before you get. And in any event, Kosovo declared independence unilaterally because it couldn't get UN Security Council support. The Americans and a number of European countries recognized Kosovo immediately. The Russians and the Serbs said they never would. Violence has broken out. Now the hope is you can freeze the violence, basically create some kind of pathway to, long-term pathway to European Union membership for Serbia so they have something to focus on.
Give them something.
And Kosovo just needs, the Kosovar leaders, the ethnic Albanians, and Western European powers need to go out of their way to actually ensure that the Serb minority in Kosovo doesn't get cleansed in the way that I think some Albanians would like to see happen.
Let's talk about the book, but then, of course, we're going to have to talk about Obama.
Why? Why? Is he in the news?
So why did you choose this particular character as the subject of this book?
Well, I just kind of can't believe he existed. I think, and A, that he existed, and B, that nobody else had written about him. It's totally bizarre to me. Here's a guy who was introduced to me as a cross between James Bond and Bobby Kennedy. He worked his entire career in
35 years, right?
35 years in violent and broken places. At a time when we as a country and a culture have begun now to talk in the cliches of transnational threats and global warming and terrorism, proliferation, and all the threats that cross borders, we don't have a model or a shepherd who himself or herself crossed borders. And so here is Sergio, who over his career sort of moves with the headlines. In the 70s, if it's wars of independence and decolonization, that's all the rage, he's there. He's in Bangladesh. He's in Cyprus for the Turkish invasion or in the aftermath of the Turkish invasion. He's in Sudan when the civil war there starts. He's in Mozambique. And not just there for 5 minutes, but there literally living
for a
year or two.
Yeah, so he's one of these heat-seeking kind of guys.
Well, that's the chasing the flame part, right?
Exactly. But the flame he's chasing has double meaning.
It does.
And hopefully he's not going there just... Yeah, I mean...
He's not merely a war junkie.
That's right.
Not by any means.
He's there dealing. Now, the central core, just before I went on the air, I mentioned this, it seemed to me the central message of this book is that at a time when nation states are not perhaps the biggest threat to stability or even justice, but it's all these fragmented things going on, someone like DeMello and DeMello's experience, his point of view, is particularly missed because of his death in Iraq.
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to look at it, that we're missing him, and we are. Another way to look at it is, my goodness, here's a guy who had a 34-year head start thinking about non-state actors, failing states, undergoverned spaces. Let's figure out what he learned in a hurry so that we don't have to go through and make some of the same mistakes he made. I mean, he was in... Just another example of his being wherever the news was. He was in Beirut in 1983 when Hezbollah blew up the U.S. Embassy in the first ever suicide attack against the United States. Of course, a few months later, the Marine barracks were hit by Hezbollah. I mean, arguably, that was the start of the new era that Americans just woke up to on 9/11. Many Americans woke up to on 9/11. In the 90s, he was the guy dealing with ethnic and sectarian conflicts, first in Bosnia, then in Rwanda and Congo. In the late 90s, when nation-building was the cause du jour, he was, as I mentioned, the viceroy in both Kosovo and East Timor, actually in charge of governing places. I mean, at that point, he became something of a—I like to think of him as a kind of decathlete of nation-building, where the 10 skills, you know, or anything from elections, constitution drafting, reconstruction, schools, policing, you know, you name it. I mean, you could go through this sort of host of skills that we don't have as a country.
Right.
And very few foreign ministries do. And then the very fact that he ended up as human rights commissioner at a time just before he went to Iraq, balancing liberty and security, because that's the key question, right, is how do you actually deal with the genuine threat of terrorism without yourself becoming so violent that you create more threats than existed before you came on the scene?
Yeah, one of the things it seems to me is, I'm going to ask you, is what are those lessons?
Mm.
You know, if I were interviewing him instead of you, what are those lessons which are in the book? And so let me ask you that. Yeah. Oh, I know the other point I was going to make was that he advised or attempted to advise Bremer, the U.S., the UN, and so on many of these issues in the early stages of Iraq and was ignored.
basically swatted away like the UN gnat.
And by the way, if people want to see, again, that time, go see No End in Sight, in which you're one of the interviewees, the film that was nominated for an Academy Award. And if you know, get that DVD. It's a very powerful one.
I agree totally. I think Charles Ferguson did an amazing job showing the degree to which, on the one hand, this war was overdetermined to be a disaster. I mean, in the sense that it was a war fought on specious grounds with no international legitimacy. We know all that. But then the beauty of that film, and I hope the importance of also telling Sergio's story in Iraq, is to see that even with all that, the original mistakes were compounded on a daily basis in that summer of 2003 before things had become violent, before Al-Qaeda had made its presence felt in Iraq. Sergio tried to get Paul Bremer to scale back his debathification decree, to try to reconstitute the armed forces, which, of course, had largely laid down their guns, wanting Saddam Hussein to be gone, assuming that there was going to be some space for them in a new Iraq. They came to Sergio and said, help us. We can't feed our families. We don't have our pensions. What are we going to do? Sergio went to Bremer and said, let's figure out what to do with these people. These are insurgents.
Yeah, at this
insurgents.
Point, they're a resource, but they're potential insurgents.
Exactly, exactly. They're insurgents in the making. And, of course, this is the time when looting had already occurred, but there had never been a large-scale attack on a civilian target prior to the attack that Sergio died in against the UN. Sergio tried to convince Bremer of a lesson that he himself had learned personally in East Timor, which is, if you hoard responsibility, you hoard blame. And that, you know, given the things, I mean, the great...
And you also have no one else invested in the outcome.
Yes.
Unless people share in the ownership, they don't own the outcome.
Yes, and interestingly, the new U.S. military counterinsurgency manual, which is a very controversial document, but one of the things that it says in its list of paradoxes is sometimes better that the locals do something badly than that you do it well. Now, the only thing worse than you doing it well is you doing it badly.
Right.
It's certainly better that they do it badly than you do it badly.
Right.
But what was so exasperating for him is here he lived for more than three decades in places that were going through transition. Iraq, obviously, hugely complicated and sui generis in terms of the challenges it posed. But nonetheless, had a huge amount of expertise to bring to bear on how to put forth transparent timetables for transition, to communicate to Iraqis where the end state was, what the destination was, even just to buy the Americans, if that's what was required, a little bit of a grace period as they began to bungle their way through that first summer, on reconstruction, on how to demobilize police or how to integrate police, how to fill the security gap. And these are all mistakes Sergio had made and lessons that he had learned over the years. And for Bremer not to see that and for ideology to get in the way, the anti-UN feeling of this administration...
Yes.
Obviously coloring the way that Bremer would hear any of those messages. The UN, didn't you guys screw up Rwanda? Didn't you, peacekeeping, oil for food, you're corrupt, you're incompetent. Those sort of stories that are told in the United States about UN missions, some of which are true. But more often than not, that corruption and that incompetence is in large measure the product of member states' lack of attentiveness or lack of resources and so forth, and certainly relative to American incompetence and corruption in Iraq, these UN failures of the 90s.
Right, it sounds
come
to me like the lessons
pale.
He learned and the places that he actually were able to influence were places where the nation states didn't have their footprint on it
hard. That's very interesting.
That if you're in a place that we or Russia or China or somebody doesn't care quite as much about, you might be able to muddle through. How did you end up working for Barack Obama?
Well, in early 2005, I got an email from his office saying he had just read my 600-page book on American responses to genocide, and he would like to get together to talk about how to fix American foreign policy. And no member of Congress, no U.S. senator, no member of the executive branch, no mayor, no city councilman had ever reached out to me in that fashion, having read the book. And when I was next in Washington, I met with him, and we were supposed to meet for an hour, and an hour gave way to 2 hours, to 3 hours, to 4 hours. And by the fourth hour, I heard myself say, why don't I quit my job at Harvard and come and intern in your office? I'll do anything, answer phones, pour coffee. I mean, I was so blown away by the scale of his ambition for national security reform and for obviously restoring our respect in the world. He read my last book in precisely the way I had intended. A lot of people read it as a book about genocide, which is a perfectly fair reading. But I saw genocide as a window into the degree to which the U.S. bureaucracy and the U.S. establishment, and this is true of many democracies, I should say, but systematically excludes consideration of human consequences in decision-making. So if you read A Problem from Hell that way, you see that Rwanda, a sin of omission, and Iraq, a sin of commission.
Well, Iraq is the obvious case where it's very hard, even in the daily reportage at this point, what are we now, 5 years later, to hear that anyone gives a damn about the people of Iraq.
Mm. Oh, it's so frustrating. Well, Obama, in fact, last summer said the same thing to me and to a group of his advisors, and just said, look, we have this false dichotomy in our debate. We have McCain saying, if we leave, we're going to make Rwanda look like a picnic. Among progressives, we're so sure, of course, that the United States is behind this meltdown in Iraq, which is true in terms of the violence following the U.S. invasion, that we have deluded ourselves perhaps into believing that when we leave, somehow things will be okay for the Iraqis, to the degree that we think about them at all. Mm-hmm. But that's the story we tell ourselves. And he said, I don't want to just get out of Iraq. I want to think about how to withdraw responsibly from Iraq. You've heard him say in the debates and so forth, I want to be more careful getting out than I was getting in. But he pulled together a working group and literally said, can we kindly have a plan that for the first time actually puts Iraqis at the center of our thinking, along, of course, with the welfare of the men and women serving the United States. And so we spent a month talking to people who just come back from Iraq, people who are just on their way there, intelligence professionals and so forth, and pulled together this responsible withdrawal plan, which involves things like fair notice for the Iraqi people, potentially using actually U.S. vehicles to move people from mixed neighborhoods to homogenous neighborhoods, tragically, if that's what they feel is better for them in the wake of a U.S. withdrawal. The creation of a war crimes commission, so you at least start to name names as to who it is, who are the culprits behind most of the massacres. A major regional refugee assistance plan, $2 billion to Iraq's neighbors so that the borders potentially can be opened again so refugees who feel trapped right now in Iraq can actually get out and seek asylum in neighboring countries.
As I'm listening, what I'm hearing is this sounds like the kind of planning that people did and was ignored.
Yeah.
Prior to the invasion, but it does sound like, I mean, exactly what he said, that this is the kind of planning you need. I'm also curious why I haven't heard much about that.
Mm.
I don't watch debates religiously, you know, and I mean, it seems like if this got out and it sort of changed where Iraq's being argued, as you say, let's say it's McCain, Obama, that it's that there is something here about these human beings, that it might wake up some people who find themselves, you know, do I trust McCain more or this young guy from Illinois?
Well, I think it has to come out. And McCain will force it out. I can't explain why it hasn't filtered down. I agree with you that it hasn't. I mean, whenever I tell people about Obama convening this group and the level of detail and granularity, they say, what? You know, I thought he just gave great speeches. and I love his speeches. And I'm going to vote for him on the basis. But, I mean, this guy, I mean, he knew going into this race that he had to clear the national security threshold. I don't think what he could have anticipated is the degree to which on everything.
And by that expression, you mean that he had to show Americans that he could be trusted with the strong part.
Absolutely. Yeah. With the red button, with the lives of American soldiers, with the security of our country.
So as a political calculation for election, that's number one.
Well, I mean, as a political calculation, as a reason you'd want to be president, obviously you want to keep the country safe. But I think that what has been amazing to watch is the degree to which he has actually set the terms of the national security debate. So on the question of whether we talk to our enemies, on the question of what we do about Cuba, I mean, Obama came out months ago and talked about the importance of opening it up and family remittances and travel and so forth as a path to normalization. On the question of Pakistan, he was the first person to come out and say, why do we have this uncritical relationship with a dictator who's losing the support of the Pakistani people and who's not cooperating in the way that we want on counterterrorism? He's asked the impertinent questions in Washington, and that is both a reflection, I think, of his judgment, but also, which he talks a lot about, but also being unbeholden to special interests and focus groups and so forth, and also to the old ways of thinking. The bandwidth for what you can say in terms of the foreign policy debate has shrunk over the years in ways that, I mean, Democrats are afraid even to mention the United Nations for fear they're going to look like they're, Birkenstock wearing peaceniks. And I think Obama has just pushed and expanded that bandwidth in a way that's going to be good for the national election, good for the country more generally. And he sees foreign policy see as his sweet spot. I mean, obviously he hasn't, served in the military, and he doesn't have those things to draw upon as McCain will. But he feels like he has amassed now this track record of judgment that's going to be a real asset.
Because of the people that advise him, you, Joe Cirincione, people like that.
No. We don't have anything to do with his judgment.
You're saying just where he comes.
This guy, he's the one who sits us down and says, okay, here's my. No, this is Robert Frost once said about a liberal. A liberal is one who is so open-minded that he doesn't take his own side in a quarrel. And Obama has this amazing ability. He has some of that insofar as he's so interested in actually hearing where everyone's at. He's a former constitutional law professor. He's got a Socratic method of extracting ideas from people. But he is so decisive at the end of a meeting, and in that sense, the antidote. I mean, in other words, he can make his own mind up in a quarrel, in anything else, but it's after actually bringing dissenting views to bear, watching other people wear ideas, and then he'll lower the blow at the end of a meeting.
We've only got about another minute of this conversation. You just referred to his former constitutional law professor, and I was going to say, people question his experience. You point out his constitutional law professor. And when I saw that, I thought to myself, I wonder how many Americans know what the president's oath of office is. Mm. And it is surprisingly short. I looked it up, The president's oath of office is, I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States of America. Nowhere does it say you will defend the people, the boundaries, the trade routes, the so on. You will defend the Constitution. I give you 30 seconds to speak to that.
Well, let me just say this. Obama's known for his great oratory on the stump, and obviously for his convention speech. The biggest applause line in Barack Obama's speeches, and this has been true long before he won Iowa, the single biggest applause line is a very simple applause line, which is, I have taught the Constitution, I will respect the Constitution, I will obey the Constitution. People go nuts. And Obama said, when did it happen that saying I'm going to obey the Constitution became an applause line in America? But I think it speaks to something that people are really hungering for, that he has managed to sort of meet them where they're at in this campaign.
Okay, thank you. I got like 6 pages of questions that we're not going to get to. You're very busy, but I'd love to have you on again, during
Anytime.
The next few months. The book is Chasing the Flame. The website is samanthapower.com. Thank you, Samantha Power. Keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence.